think Tom heard it. I'll say thank you again, Tom, for the invitation and the opportunity to speak again at the Fields Institute. So I'm going to talk about a problem in credit risk that I have been working on with Thalia Zarifoplou from the University of Texas recently, and it's applying a method of utility valuation for credit derivatives, and in particular CDOs, which many of you here in the industry may be familiar with. So it goes without saying, and this is well reported, and here are some numbers testifying to it, that the credit market has grown enormously, particularly over the last 5 years. So here are some figures quantifying the size of that increase. And what we have seen is that credit derivatives which depend on how many and whether or not certain firms default on their debts, whether bond obligations are not met, loans are not paid, have become increasingly complex. And the main kind of credit derivative CDOs that I'll be talking about obviously display that in their definition. But of course, the quantitative technology, the mathematics, the engineering, the financial engineering is much behind. The products are extremely complicated, and we're a long way behind in terms of any kind of satisfactory mathematical tools or computational tools for dealing with their valuation, which is mainly what I'm talking about, and even more difficult, hedging. And the major problem is the high dimensionality. So we are talking about credit derivatives that may depend on how many of a basket of, say, 125 firms are going to default over the next 5 years. So this is a high dimensional problem. And essentially what we have seen is that the computational tractability of addressing this problem severely limits what we can do. And you know, I would say, in my opinion, this is an extremely hard problem, much higher than things that we deal with in equity derivatives and interest rate derivatives. That the dimensionality and the computational burden make this a really very challenging problem. And so I will say up front that I don't claim to have the answer here today. And mainly what I'm going to be talking about is how we, like many other people, have bashed our heads against this problem, and by taking a slightly different approach to some of the others. But there's still a long way to go, and because of computational issues, we have to make, you know, grossly simplifying assumptions. So before I was interested in credit risk, I went to many talks where it was very fashionable, and I'm sure many people here have heard talks where people get up and say copulas are terrible, terrible things that people are using to value CDOs, and this has even made it to the front page of the Wall Street Journal about a year and a half ago in a very famous article talking about how copulas were overused in the credit market. And that is, of course, true. I don't disagree with that. But it has become a cliche. And I think, you know, what was eye-opening for me was that it's only when you try and compute something with CDOs, prices, anything, and deal with this computational challenge that you understand why people in practice are using copulas. It's not because they're lazy or technologically challenged or something like that. It's just hard to come up with something else that is tractable. So I'm not proposing copulas here, but I will be making choices that are for purely computational concerns as we go on through, and you'll see why I'll be making those choices. So what is so this is the major problem. This is the major problem analytically, and what is the major challenge? So one of the major challenges is to explain and capture, to have a model which explains or describes the high premiums that you observe for so-called senior tranches, which are based on very unlikely events. So, for example, you have super senior tranches which will pay off their holder some money if 15 to 30% of investment-grade U.S. firms default in the next 5 years. And that, despite what happened yesterday, is relatively, if not extremely, unlikely. And if it happened, we'd probably have bigger concerns than worrying about how these things are priced and hedged and so on and so forth. And yet, they're trading over the counter or in relatively illiquid situations for a relatively high premium. Anything above zero is relatively high. So people are reaping a few basis points reward for these things. And so what are ways that we could try and capture or describe or model mathematically this phenomena? The obvious way is correlation, that defaults are very correlated. If 10 firms go, then maybe 20 firms will go and 40 firms will go. And the default condition is very correlated, either through economic factors or you know, direct business relationships and so on and so forth. And that's, of course, important. But I think when you look at these kind of numbers, you sense there is something more than any kind of realistic correlation. And so the obvious other approach or the other factor to look at is risk aversion, that what we're looking here at are high premium for tails of distributions. And we could try and jack up the tails of a distribution by increasing the correlation. That's one approach. Or you could try and say that such a phenomenon is not realistically captured, is not really realistically reflective of taking an expectation under some distribution, which we have to bulge to reproduce these kind of numbers, but they're simply crashophobia. They are due to sort of intrinsic phenomena. And so that's really what I want to describe, is this part of the equation. And so I will ignore correlation for most of the talk and come back to it towards the end. And the mechanism that people have developed over the years for quantifying risk aversion in terms of valuation is the so-called utility indifference valuation, which I will describe in some detail. So utility indifference valuation, or derivative pricing. So it's a generalization of this equation. There's some utility function, and we'll choose a specific one in a second. And you ask, what price is the utility of this certain quantity P equal to the expected utility of the random quantity X? That is certainty equivalent. And indifference pricing, or utility indifference valuation, is just a dynamic generalization of this, where you take into the account trading opportunities in some financial market. So this is some static calculation, and a dynamic version of it, which accounts for continuous trading, is what's called indifference pricing these days. And this may be, so of course, once you make the choice of going with a preference-based valuation method, this seems a reasonable, rational framework in which to compare the values of different risky securities. And I don't think it's appropriate in very liquid markets, but in relatively illiquid markets or over-the-counter, or where things are trading between very individualistic customers, hedge funds, and so on, this may be a reasonable thing to investigate. And this has been applied, if you haven't come across it before, there are some conferences in academics where you go to and every other talk is on indifference pricing, but on the other hand, it's quite believable that that people have not come across this before, but it has been applied in many other situations, options on non-traded assets, weather derivatives, and there's even a book which should appear this year or next year on indifference pricing. Now, of course, the method has to be computationally tractable. It's a valuation which is defined by the solution of some optimization problems. And essentially, that means you have to take exponential utility, which has some undesirable properties, but I'm going to take that throughout. So the utility function that you see here is minus e to the minus gamma x, and gamma is the coefficient of risk aversion. So the greater gamma, the more risk averse the point of view of comparison. And then the key feature that I want to import from utility valuation is this nonlinear pricing rule. So when you have a mechanism like this, it's, you know, where it differs most in terms of arbitrage-free pricing or pricing with respect to some expectation is that the prices are nonlinear. The prices of two of something are not two times the price of one. So in very liquid markets for small quantities, that is not something that you would want necessarily for the price of two options not to be equal to two times the price of one option. But here I want to take that, I want to use that to take advantage of the fact that with indifference valuation, the price of a basket is, the risk of a basket is severely enhanced from the combination of the individual risks, which is one thing that correlation is trying to do, and this is another way to do it. And here are some references, these are all in the last two, 3 years, of other people who have also dealt with single name credit and indifference pricing. So this is the picture that essentially motivates this nonlinearity. So under quite general circumstances, you can prove for the stock price being a semi-martingale and, you know, very mild conditions, that the indifference price, so what's plotted here is, I haven't described the mechanism, but it gives you some price. And so here's the indifference price of some claim as a function of the quantity. So zero, the price of zero is zero. And of course, as the quantity increases, the price increases. And here, there's a slight abuse when I say price. This is the buyer's price, and this is the negative of the seller's price. And typically, you see a curve like this. It's strictly concave. It's differentiable. From the point of view of the buyer, and various things are known about this curve. For example, the limit of the slope as the quantity goes to zero and it goes to infinity and minus infinity, the slope at zero, which is sometimes called the marginal price or the Davis price. But I'm not going to use any of that. But this is just to illustrate that for securities on single names things, this is the kind of nonlinear pricing rule that you typically see from this mechanism. So let me then first talk, so I want to do two things. First, I want to talk about single name credit derivatives, which is in some sense relatively easy, but this is to illustrate what utility, I think it's easier to see what utility valuation is doing in terms of single name credit derivatives than it is when we go to the multidimensional, and then I want to get to the CDOs and things like that. So here's the very simple model. So you have a firm on which on whose default the credit risk is, the credit derivative is written. S is the value, is the stock price of that firm. And, you know, I mean, this could, of course, be an index. It doesn't have to be that firm. Let's take it to be the stock price of that firm for just to fix ideas. But it's not a structural model. The default occurs not by looking at this, but it's more of it's an intensity model. So there is some default time whose intensity, lambda t, is some function of a correlated diffusion process y. So S is the stock driven by, it's a geometric Brownian motion, it's driven by W1, and y is some diffusion process correlated, so it's driven by two independent Brownian motions, W1 and W2, correlated with some coefficient rho with the value of the firm or the stock price of the firm, and the intensity is just some function, which I won't specify particularly, of this correlated diffusion. And the default occurs the first time this is a Cox process model or a standard intensity model, but it's easy to think of it as the first time that a standard Poisson process N, where the time is transformed by the cumulated intensity, it's the first time that this thing jumps. Or in other words, you could think of it like this, that this lambda, this stochastic lambda defines a clock, lambda is some positive function. So the default occurs the first time that the cumulative intensity hits some standard exponential normal random variable xc. So this is a standard default model. The only thing is that I'm writing the firm, the stock price of the firm as well. So the intensity, in some sense, is correlated with the stock price of the firm. But the default comes as a surprise. It's not predictable. So it's an intensity model. And now, for the utility valuation, there are two things that we have to do. So we have the utility function, minus e to the minus gamma x, and we have to ask the question, at what value is the buyer of this, I haven't said what the credit derivative is yet, but I'll come to that, at what price is he or she indifferent in terms of maximum expected utility between holding and not holding the derivative? So there are two options. One, where you solve a portfolio optimization problem where there is default risk, the stock price may the stock may default, and another where you solve the optimization problem, but also with the credit derivative, and then we have to compare the values of these two and adjust the price such that these two things become equal. So here are some details. I will go through these relatively rapidly, but if people want to ask questions, please go ahead. So one has to solve a stochastic control problem, which is standard in these things. So there is a wealth process X. So let's talk about problem one first, the plain Merton problem. So pi denotes the dollar amount to put in the stock. And then you have the standard equation, essentially, of how the portfolio evolves between putting some money pi in the stock and some money and the rest of the money in the bank. So this is the standard wealth evolution equation. And this holds up to the random time capital tau, which is when the default occurs. And after the default occurs, the stock disappears, and the money has, and all that is left is the bank. So all the money has to be transferred to the bank. And so, to cut a long story short, this is the value function for this essentially pure Merton problem, but with the risk of default. So this tells you that what we're trying to solve is the soup of our investment strategies of the expected payoff, where there are two conditions to consider, and everything here is in discounted variables. One where the So there is some time horizon capital T, I should have said. So this is the standard one where the default does not occur before the end of the time horizon. And this is the one where the default does occur before the end of the time horizon. And then you have to take into effect the what happens when you transfer your money from the stock to the only thing you're allowed, which is the bank, and this is what you get. So this is for people who know these problems, this is relatively standard. This is the Merton problem here. And then there are tricks that you can do to get to a PDE problem, a partial differential equation problem, for the solution of these. So in particular, this is a function. I didn't write it on the previous slide, but by dynamic programming, you write it as a function of the current date, the current wealth, and the current level of the intensity driving process. And you can separate variables. You can pull out the minus e to the minus gamma x factor and reduce to a solution of this u of t and y. And then basically what happens with stochastic intensities is that you can simplify the problem to some extent, but at the end you have to solve a reaction diffusion equation. So up to here, this is a diffusion equation, and then you have a nonlinear term, which is u, the unknown, to some power, as it turns out, and this power is rho squared over 1 minus rho squared. Rho is the correlation. So essentially, that's quite tractable numerically. This is the level to which, under stochastic intensities, you can reduce the problem. And now, to illustrate, I'm going to go even simpler. Before I get to that, sorry. So in a second, before I will illustrate with a simpler case. So this is what you get at the level of the first stochastic control problem. And then there's a second stochastic control problem where you add the claim, which I didn't tell you what that is yet. So the claim is just a defaultable bond. It pays you $1 if the expiration date occurs after the expiration date. So indicate a function of tau bigger than t. Let me define c to be e to the minus rt. This is just the discount factor over the time period. And there is a value function associated with this problem, which is essentially the same as what we had before, except at expiration, if the default has not occurred, the guy gets, after discounting, e to the minus rt, or in discounted variables, e to the minus rt, which is this c. So basically, this is the same kind of stochastic control problem, but here is the credit derivative. That's the only difference between the two things. And then we can try the same thing, separation of variables, and this trick where you make this unknown function to a power, and you get another, basically, essentially the same reaction diffusion equation, except with this factor here for the credit derivative. And then the difference price, which is the thing that we're interested in, is given by the solution of this equation. When is the maximum expected utility without the derivative equal to the maximum expected utility with the derivative, but when we have paid some price p initially? So this is just the version of that equation, u of p is equal to expectation of u of x. This is the dynamic certainty equivalent type thing. And then you rearrange all these calculations, and p is just given basically by the default free bond price minus some factor with the risk aversion coefficient times the log of the solution of these two reaction diffusion equations. W is this one, and U is the previous one that we had before on the slide. So everything is very simple, and as I mentioned before, I want to just go even simpler, which is, now forget the stochastic intensity. So not particularly realistic, but let's just see what happens in the case where lambda is constant. So this is just a defaultable bond, and the default time is just some exponential random variable with mean 1 over lambda. And in this case, it's not PDEs, it's just ODEs, and everything simplifies and it's tractable. And this is a formula for the indifference price, which depends on some quantity alpha. So what this thing depends on, of course, is the maturity. It depends on the Sharpe ratio of the stock, of the firm stock, and it depends on the intensity of default lambda. So this is basically the key ingredients into this formula. And what is of interest as we look at single name credit derivatives is to look at the yield spread. So what is the yield over a default free bond after taking the log. So the Y0 is just the yield spread as predicted by this indifference valuation. And here, hopefully you can see the pictures, are two graphs which show the yield spreads as a function of maturity up to 10 years, up to 10 years. This is for the buyer, this is for the seller, and the different colored curves are different risk aversions. And the arrow points in the direction of increasing risk aversion. So let's say from the point of view of the buyer, if you have increasing risk aversion, he demands a higher yield spread than one with a lower risk aversion. And for the seller, obviously, it's the opposite. He wants to give a lower yield spread. The units of yield spread are unitless. Up here, this is in... no, this is not in basis points. This is in percent. Yeah, 0.18. So it's a little bit. I won't say these are realistic numbers or anything like that. But these are high numbers. So these are the coefficients that I've chosen here. Quite a strong intensity of default, which is probably why that thing is so high. And then the other thing, the main thing that I want to point out with this picture is that of course these curves are not flat. So remember, this is with a constant intensity, so if you were doing any kind of valuation, this would predict any kind of, you know, arbitrage-free valuation, expectation under some measure, then the yield spreads would of course be flat across maturities. They would just be lambda. And so here, the point of showing this picture from this sort of toy calculation is that the effect of risk aversion is to produce non-trivial yield spreads, even with constant intensities. So without going to stochastic intensities, and of course with stochastic intensities, the effect will be enhanced, this produces non-trivial yield spread. So the indifference mechanism has this effect for the single name credit risk securities. Okay, so then what I want to do is pass to the multi-name, which is of course the interesting thing. So here, the indifference valuation is kind of trying to do the work, if we don't build in any a priori correlation, it's trying to do the work of the correlation by risk aversion. So let me generalize the previous model that we had before. So there are n firms, so n is on the order of 100. And these are their stock prices, again, geometric Brownian motions. Everything is under subjective measure. There's no other measure going on. So these are geometric Brownian motions with excess growth rates mu I, volatility sigma I, driven by Brownian motions, which are a priori correlated with some constant correlations, rho ij. So these are the correlated stock prices, the usual thing that you have. And then the firm I defaults at some exponentially distributed random variable time tau sub I with parameter lambda I. So here I'm going straight to constant intensity, and I'll come back to stochastic intensity at the end. So here it's constant intensity. So this is obviously, you have now this undesirable feature, the default times are independent, and they're independent of these Brownians because they are constant intensities. So this is the simplest case. In other words, if you were looking for the loss distribution, it would just be binomial as a combination of these things. So let's start at this case. So there is no a priori correlation between the default times, which are exponential with parameters lambda I. And then we have to generalize the previous calculation, which I won't go too much into the details of. But there is a wealth process now, and now you have to look at pi. This is a multi, a multi-stock portfolio optimization problem. So pi I is the dollar amount in each stock, in the ith stock. So this is the wealth process up until the ith firm defaults, in which case it disappears. So this is the generalization of the previous equation. But of course, each of these stocks could disappear when the tau i's occur, when the random times of default occur. And now, but we are with constant intensity. So for the Merton problem, the problem, I haven't even said what the credit derivative is yet. But let's suppose we're trying to maximize expected exponential utility of terminal wealth. Then there is some AJB equation associated with this stochastic control problem that is given here. And then up to the first two terms, this is the standard thing that you have in Merton's problem with no credit risk, with just standard portfolio optimization with geometric Brownian motion. So these are the first two terms of this this equation. And then you see here where the credit risk occurs. So with over a small time with probability lambda I, the ith firm defaults, and you have to replace the value function with n stocks with the value functions with n minus 1 stocks, where the ith firm is the one that disappeared. So you can see that there's a whole sort of cascade of these problems that we have to keep track of, not only the number of stocks, so the superscript tells you that there are n firms alive, but you have to keep track of which ones have defaulted, not just how many are left. And so now we hit, of course, the huge combinatorial problem that people run to copulas for to get away from, which is that you have this enormous informational problem that you when, for example, let's say K firms have defaulted, let's say 50 firms have defaulted, you have to solve the problems, the Merton problems and the associated other problems, for 100 choose 50 combinations of possible firms left. So this we have tried, but we can only get, even with sort of memory management, we can only get up to about 20 or 25. So this thing is, this thing I don't believe, unless Moore's law speeds up a little bit, is going to be a realistic approach. This combinatorial problem of really trying to keep track of all the information as to which firms have defaulted, which ones are still around, for 125 dimensional or even larger problem, it becomes just unwieldy and essentially untractable. So I have to go symmetric, which is sort of what one does with the copula type models that are used in industry. And so now I want to simplify this model so that I can get away with just keeping track of how many firms have defaulted and not which ones. So now the assumptions, of course, have to become they have to become very simplifying. So what I want to assume, if we go back to this Helmholtz-Jacobi equation, you can see that the important information from, I didn't point this out, from the dynamics of the stock prices is contained in this number. Mu is the vector of returns. A is the variance-covariance matrix, the sigma-sigma transpose, the volatility and the covariance matrix. And this quadratic form, this sort of multidimensional Sharpe ratio, contains the information about the growth rates of the stock. So essentially the assumption is that I want to assume that suppose there are little n stocks left, and in general we have to keep track of which n stocks are left, which is given by some generic index set here. The assumption is going to be that this quantity, this multidimensional Sharpe ratio, mu transpose A inverse, sigma sigma transpose mu, is a function only of the cardinality of this set. It only depends on how many stocks are n is counting how many are alive, not how many are dead. And this function is, of course, a measure of diversity. The more stocks that are alive, the greater is your market, the diversity of your market. So it's natural to call this a diversity function. And so what I want to assume is that this function is only a function of n. And it's natural that this function is obviously increasing in n. The more stocks that are alive, the more diverse is your investment opportunity set. And it's concave in the sense that you have decreasing marginal benefit of adding firms. The benefit of 100 firms over 99 firms is much less than the benefit of two firms over one firm. So a priori, you could take this as an input into the simplified model, or you could try and come up with a model in which this assumption holds. And the obvious one is to take all the parameters to be identical. So to take all the growth rates to be mu, to take all the volatilities to be sigma, and to take this identical pairwise correlation structure, which we do in the one-factor Gaussian copula, which is to say that the Brownians, the correlation between any two of the Brownians, is the same number rho throughout. And so if you do that, then you compute this quadratic form, then this is the diversity function. So it goes like n plus 1 over, plus some constant over n in some sense. So mu squared over sigma squared is here, the rho is here. And so then it's interesting to look at what this diversity function is as a function of n. So here are plots of this in that case as a function of the number of firms. So if there's no correlation between the firms, if the firms are independent, if the stock prices of the firms are independent, as you add more and more firms, your diversity shoots up very rapidly. This is this line here. You adding more independent random variables is extremely beneficial very rapidly, which is what this is showing here. And then as you add stocks which are correlated, here is 0.05 correlation, here is 0.1, 0.25, 0.5, and here perfectly correlated through the Brownian motions, the benefit of adding more firms tails off increasingly rapidly. So, for example, when they're perfectly correlated, there's no benefit to adding more firms. And so as far as the Merton problem is concerned, how many firms have defaulted is not is not affecting that coefficient which comes into it. And so even for correlation of 0.25, for the numbers that I have chosen, after about 20 firms, this diversity function levels off extremely rapidly. So this, in some sense, is what I want to take as the outside information about the market. And now, in this grossly reduced case, let me talk about how the problem reduces and what kind of things come out of it. So I have to solve a Merton problem, which depends on the number of firms that are, by construction, by design, this is a set of functions which depend only on the number of firms which are alive. I'm counting how many are alive, not dead. So mn of tnx is the value function when there are n firms alive. And you can do a separation of variables, and now everything is down to ordinary differential equations. So if you separate variables, mn of tnx is minus e to the minus gamma x times some function of t, which is v sub n, then these v's satisfy a system of ordinary differential equations which look like this. That each one is connected through the intensity lambda to the one where there are n minus 1 firms left, as you would expect. The diversity coefficient goes into this coefficient alpha n, so this is the diversity coefficient and something to do with the intensity, so these all go here. And then you have a system of ordinary differential equations which you could solve explicitly, but it's perhaps easier to solve recursively, but there is an explicit solution for these ordinary differential equations as combinations of exponentials of these alphas, so this is given here. So the Vn looks like this. There are some coefficients, there's some C0 coefficient and some Cj coefficients times each of the exponentials, and these Cs satisfy this recursive structure. So basically it becomes an algebraic recursion in this simplified setting, but it's just easier possibly just to solve the ODEs numerically than to deal with these recursion coefficients, which are not necessarily ideally stable. But in any case, you can solve it very, very rapidly, very easily. So in the special case where the Brownian motions driving the stocks are completely uncorrelated, where the rho is equal to zero, you recover some binomial coefficients. You recover the binomial coefficients given here, n choose j, p to the n minus j, 1 minus p to the j, where p is in particular this this probability, lambda over lambda plus mu squared over 2 sigma squared. So that's one special case, but of course we're interested in cases where there is correlation, in which case the stocks are not driven by independent Brownian motions. Okay, so this is what happens. So far I have not talked about any credit derivative. This is just the stochastic control problem with default risk when the stock prices are correlated. So next we have to get into we have to get kind of dirty and look at the CDOs, which I haven't said anything about for a while. So I'll run through the mechanics of CDOs. I'm sure most people here are familiar with this, maybe intimately familiar with this on a day-to-day basis. So N is the number of firms underlying the CDO and Q is the total notional. And to preserve symmetry, I'm going to have to be in a situation like the index where the notionals are equal across the various firms, because I only want to keep track of how many firms have defaulted so far and not which ones. And then these CDOs are characterized by attachment and detachment points, which are like strike prices. So KL is the lower attachment point, KU is the upper attachment point. And these different tranches are given here with their various attachment points. And what is, I guess I should say, in case people have not come across them, what is a CDO tranche? A CDO tranche is a contract between the protection seller, who's the tranche holder, and the protection provider, in which the protection seller provides protection against the default of this basket of N firms. So for example, the holder of the equity tranche provides protection against the first 3% losses in the total notional, and so when those losses start occurring, he starts paying the unrecovered lost amount to the person who bought the protection. But until his tranche is blown, he receives a premium on the remaining notional. So this premium capital R is essentially the price that we're interested in. So in some sense, this is a derivative quoted as a sort of swap, and we need to find what this R is. The game is what is the premium that the tranche holder receives for his tranche. And these tranches, so here are the numbers for some standardized tranche, the CDX. The equity tranche insures the first 3% of losses, and so there is a very high premium on this. The mezzanine tranche insures the next 4%, the mezzanine 1, the mezz 2, the next 3%, the senior tranche, the 10 to 15, and the super senior, the 15 to 30. And this is, in some sense, there are reasonable theories, even dynamic theories, albeit computational, which can perhaps go after the first four with a lot of parameters, but the last one seems something that to match what one observes, a lot of work has to be put into capturing this anywhere near what is observed. Okay, so this is the structure, and then a little bit of the analysis. Then, so we want to find the R such that the guy is indifferent between holding the tranche or not. I'll assume some fixed fractional recovery parameter Q between 0 and 1. And in fact, I'll solve for a coupon payment which is inflated with the discount rate. This is just for simplicity. And then to cut a long story short, this kind of function, this put spread function, defines essentially the payoff structure of the CDO. So there is some function which is like a put struck at KU minus a put struck at KL. So this is called F of L. LN is the running losses when there are N firms alive. So everything here is backward than is standard. So 1 minus Q is the recovery. N minus N is the number of firms defaulted. LN is the number of losses. FN is the payment that you make between when there are N firms left and N minus 1 firms left. So this object comes into it. And so the modified portfolio is as follows, that what we're looking for is this tranche premium R, which is paid on the remaining notional, which is given here. So this is how the dynamics are altered for the premium structure. And we want to, and you have to take into account that this guy has to pay out when the losses occur, which is contained in this little f function. So I'll skip the details of all of this, but suffice it to say that there are these two functions, capital F and little f, which characterize the two payment streams of the CDO. These go into this value function somehow. Essentially, you are solving a chain of ordinary differential equations as before, where this beta contains the capital F, the one direction of payments, and the little f contains the other direction of payments. The R is here. And so just as a control problem, basically it's choosing the R. It's choosing the R such that the solution of this equation is equal to the solution of the previous equations without the claim. And you can solve this explicitly and so on and so forth. And this is what this line is saying, that the indifference value of the tranche spread is solving for at time zero, when all n firms are left, this is the thing associated with the tranche holder. This is the thing associated with the guy without the tranche, and for what spread value are these two equal? And so that's the setup, and let me just look at some of the pictures then. So here are 25 firms, not n equals, n equals 100 is on the next slide. Lambda here is just 1.5 percent. The homogeneous growth rates are 7%, the volatility is 15%, the correlation is 0.3 between the Brownian, the recovery is 40%, the interest rate is 3, the maturity is 5, and the notional is normalized to $1 or 1 unit of account per firm. And then what we see here is the by the previous calculation, the spread for different values of risk aversion. So here is equity, and here is the first mezzanine, here's the second mezzanine. Obviously, these are not put on the same graph because the scales are very different. So this is in basis points. And I haven't used this convention of how the equity is paid, so this is just done in the same way as all of the others. So very high premium for the equity tranches, going up rapidly as the risk aversion increases. And then lower tranches for the mezzanines. And then you see for the seniors, you can see that there it takes a hell of a high risk aversion to get this thing off its feet. So here the risk aversion coefficient, essentially for the seniors and the super seniors, is predicting very, very low spreads. And the senior doesn't wake up until about a risk aversion of 2. The super senior doesn't wake up, you know, and here we only have a handful of basis points, as you observe, until you get to almost 4 for the risk aversion coefficient. So here, remember, with independent defaults, the risk aversion is doing something, but of course one has to make this more realistic in order to have. I mean, you could look at this two ways. You could say, obviously, the different things that you observe in the market reflect different risk aversions for holders of different tranches. So you need a much more risk-averse holder to explain the high basis points for the super senior tranches, which is what you see here, than you do for the lowers. Or as a valuation mechanism, it's important to start around a model which has some a priori correlation, which is essentially what we're working on. This is the picture, because I'm almost out of time, so this is the picture for 100 firms, so it's computationally more challenging, but the effect is essentially the same. It's the same structure of picture that I had before. And so let me say a word before I close about the stochastic intensity case, which is we're in the middle of, but we don't have it. We only have preliminary calculations at the moment. So far, the risk aversion is trying to do all the work, and really we would like to start with a model that, in the absence of risk aversion, there is some correlation between the defaults. So the obvious way to do that is to have stochastic intensity. But with the dimensional problem in mind, the simplest way to do this is to have a common factor for the intensity. So I'm going to take the intensities lambda I to be some function lambda of a diffusion process y. So here are the stocks again. And for simplicity, the same growth rates and the same volatilities driven by their own Brownian motions. The pairwise correlation between the Brownian motions is rho. And then there is some exogenous diffusion process y driven by its Brownian motion z, which is correlated identically with each of the Brownian motions. So there is some other correlation m which correlates the intensity driving process with the stocks. But the important thing is that the correlations are not constant, they're changing over time, and the intensities are identical, in fact. So that doesn't mean the defaults are perfectly correlated, but they're highly correlated because their intensities happen to be identical in this simplest one-factor setting. But of course, now the price you pay is that when you go with this, you have to now solve, instead of a system of ordinary differential equations, a system of reaction diffusion differential equations, because you have the stochastic intensity. So that's obviously, yeah. So that's obviously the price that we have to pay for this kind of thing, and we basically it's a computational challenge, certainly in the heterogeneous case and in the symmetric case. But you'll see that you don't need such extreme utility risk aversions to enhance the effect of the real correlation. So this is the direction we're going, where you have a priori correlation through stochastic intensities in this fashion. Okay, so here's my conclusion. Basically, most of this I have said that even with constant intensities, the risk aversion produces non-trivial yield spreads. And I didn't show implied correlations, but if you want to measure it like that, you can do so. The effect so far is through the non-linearity of the indifference pricing rules. The price you have to pay for any kind of computational tractability is some sort of homogeneity or symmetry in the parameters, but it's possible to get away from constant intensities, which we're doing now. And then I just mentioned this last problem, which is kind of a byproduct of this calculation. So obviously the utility valuation is very different from what is practiced currently. For hedging, using utility functions or loss functions is a natural thing. So a byproduct of this calculation is in these stochastic control problems is, of course, the hedging problem, even though it's being used as a step towards this indifference valuation. You have to solve a problem where you are essentially trying to optimally hedge the risk of a CDO tranche, in this case just by trading the underlying stock. But it seems natural to try and solve this kind of optimization problem with static positions, with dynamic positions in the stocks and static positions in, you know, for example, the single name credit derivatives, the CDSs. So in other words, to optimally use the underlying firm value or the underlying stocks traded dynamically, and single name credit derivatives traded statically to hedge CDO risk. And I'll stop there. Thank you.